I'm Pete Ludovic, along with my ever-effervescent co-host, a man who thinks the Cartoon Network is an internet developed by Barney Rubble, Bill Hunt.
Hello, good morning.
How you doing, Bill?
Good, good.
All right. So I guess we want to begin the show with an apology to our more sensitive listeners. Last week, you may recall, we had some of the comedic stylings of Kostaki Economopoulos, who claimed that, in fact, Marshmallow may belong on the periodic table. We did, in fact, debunk that myth, but some of his other comedic stylings on the flavor of tequila we played, because, of course, tequila was announced as one of our new sponsors here on the show. So anyone that was offended by the mention of perspiring gonads of canine familiaris, we apologize. All right, so before we get into science and the news, anything you want to mention, Bill?
No, well, just that Georgia Tech beat Duke in basketball. It's the only sport that I care anything about, and that was fun this week.
So basketball. All right, well, that's good.
Georgia Tech basketball.
That's good, because, the football season finished on a bit of a fizzle, didn't it?
There was some hope there in the bowl game. But
There was. But I don't know about you, every time I meet with anyone from UGA, I'm still taking a lot of heat from those guys.
That's true. You will for the following year, for the next year.
So let's talk a little bit about science in the news before we get to our guest, who will be talking about bugs that eat everything. And I use that with great poetic license. Dr. Frank Lifflers can explain that a little bit better. If you're a fan of PBS, I just want to point out that PBS here in Georgia and nationwide is airing three new science shows. The experiment they're carrying out is that throughout January, PBS will broadcast three new science programs. Only one program will eventually become a regular science series on PBS. And they want us, the viewers, to help them decide. So watch the programs on your local PBS station beginning January 1st, and you'll eventually be able to vote for which ones you like the best and give your feedback on the PBS.org website. One is called Wired Science. That aired originally Wednesday, January 3rd, and deals with sort of the edgy approach to science and electronics technology that you see in Wired magazine. Next is Science Investigators, and that originally aired January 10th. And this basically deals with vignettes looking into various aspects of science and technology, and features one from our own, from the Georgia Tech community, Bahare Azizi, who is a PhD graduate from the Georgia Institute of Technology in the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry. She majored in biochemistry, and I know because she happens to be the wife of James Broering, one of our former PhD students, who I know quite well. I used to play Ultimate Frisbee with him a lot, and he always accused me of wearing way too much Bengay. Again, that aired January 10th. That's what happens when you're old.
It shouldn't be that close to you that he could. Yeah, but anyway.
Well, no, I mean, you know.
It's very aromatic.
Okay, that's how much Bengay
it's disturbing.
I wear.
It's disturbing.
Right? You think it's the smell of wintergreen, but oh no, it's the smell of middle age. I did nothing but 10 minutes of middle age jokes at the Showcase Comedy Lounge last night, which was hosted by our own Sean Lesser, who does a Wednesday 5 o'clock show on stand-up comedy. The third is sort of a futuristic show that looks at technology and science in the future called 22nd Century, and that will air Wednesday, January 17th. So for those of you that have missed the original airings of Wired Science and Science Investigators, as with most PBS stations, they air these things constantly, mainly at 2 o'clock in the morning. So if you're a normal person with a life, you may find it difficult to watch them. You can watch them on the website, or I plan on TiVoing them and taking a look at those shows. Okay, other science in the news? Well, Ralph died, the whale shark.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so did you know that?
Was it a drug overdose?
No, I believe it was a car accident.
Car accident? Got it.
And there's articles in it that you can read this morning, actually, in the Atlanta
Journal-Constitution. He had taken out a loan, and a loan shark got after him. Sorry.
And there was also one by Shayla Dewan in the New York Times, pointing out that we really don't know why. So the unfortunate thing is that he died, but...
he was a teenager, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Perhaps
it was adolescent.
Teen shark angst or something.
Yes.
Like that, or shark
there you
teen
go.
Angst or, yeah.
Too much Prozac in with the krill.
I think so, yeah.
This is what you're suggesting. And that very well.
Well, he was wearing a grill and he was trying to eat krill, so that was...
And a very interesting thing, it's probably being played over and over again on PBS as well, and that is the... there's a show on the Georgia Aquarium, And it was funny because it begins with, I believe, Bernie Marcus saying, you know, we think we're doing a good thing here because many of these fish would have already been eaten. So I laughed at that, too. I was thinking, you know, eating whale sharks? Who eats whale sharks? But according to both these articles, this whale shark that was in Taiwan eventually would have been eaten. So,
really? Like he would have been an entree?
You know, the shark fin and whale shark soup. I don't know. Yeah, you could have gotten them at your local Chinese restaurant.
Yeah, so, or the McDonald's whale shark burger.
And I have no idea. Whale shark. Tastes like chicken, maybe.
Yeah.
So, in fact, you know, he was here for a couple of years longer.
Actually, shark tastes like scallops, but that's...
Does it taste like scallops? Well, I eat shark a lot. I eat scallops. I like scallops.
Yeah.
Sharks.
Oh, yeah.
I'm probably eating the wrong part of the shark.
Probably.
I'm guessing. So, another very interesting thing in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution this morning... and again, we like to stress the fact that, you know, science isn't always on the science page in the New York Times. In the Buyer's Edge section for today's paper, at the very bottom of the front page, it talks about everyday things around the house that can save time. And a lot of these, okay, I hadn't had my caffeine yet this morning when I was reading them, looked a little goofy. For example, they recommend lemonade Kool-Aid in your dishwasher, you know, the little detergent cup, to reduce lime deposits. And that actually made a lot of sense once I read the little blurb on it, because it's citric acid, and acids will take lime away. You could have used acetic acid, which is in vinegar, but that's a liquid, so maybe that's a little unwieldy. So it's basically any powdered weak acid. And by weak acid, I mean, you know, citric, you know, carboxylic acid. Mm-hmm. We've actually talked about that a bit before, versus, say, hydrochloric sulfuric, these really strong acids. So just remember, though, use the one without the sugar.
Yeah, and don't, or if you're old school, don't use two cups
of sugar with it. That's probably going to gunk the thing.
Right.
Another very interesting one is they talk about using chalk. Take a little bit of chalk and wrap it in some cheesecloth and store it with your silver. And they point out that the chalk is moisture-absorbing. So basically, chalk is very, very dry. It's a desiccant, something that dries things. And before the program, we were talking about the fact that they put these in products all the time, even food products. Because when you get water in, say, salt crystals or something like that, it messes things up.
Well, this is Heloise's Hints. Is that still out there in any form?
Oh, I don't know. But I used to read those.
My mom used to always read those for different little tidbits, you know, putting salt, rice.
Right, and rice is the desiccant.
The same sort of reason, but these are there is a reason behind these things.
And so it's commonly used, but despite that, they still put in big, large, bold letters, "Do not eat" on the desiccant in food packaging. So you don't want to do that. It's usually a salt, like a calcium carbonate.
Which is bad for me. I like watching a movie and eating desiccants.
Yes, you're weird that way, man.
Yeah.
I've always
chalk. I'm not really sure.
And then finally, they have an interesting one about using cooking spray, like PAM, basically vegetable oil, to speed dry your manicure. It says the oil helps dissolve the polish's solvent and prevents lint from sticking to wet nails. That's probably a bit of a misnomer. It doesn't speed dry it. The solvent they use in nail polish, usually acetone or an acetate ester, is very volatile. That means it dissolves quickly. So that's why it's coming up and it's in the air and it's making you a little stoned because it is dissolving into the air. By putting vegetable oil, which will dissolve with it, that's actually higher molecular weight, dissolves slower. So it doesn't speed dry it, but probably what it does is it mixes with it, makes a very thick, solid-like coating, so it's tacky quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually dries slower, but it keeps you from getting lint on your nails. So actually, we're getting ready to take a break here. Do we want to introduce our guests just before we go, or wait till after the break?
We'll wait till after the break.
Okay, so we're going to talk about microbes used in bioremediation with Professor Frank Loeffler from the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering, as well as the School of Biology at Georgia Tech. We'll be right back after the break here on Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, RadioSandySprings.com, and 1620 AM.
Inside the Black Box. How come it's a black box? Why couldn't it be the yellow and purple box?
Well, I guess there's this expression that engineers have been beating to death for a long time that, you know, you don't, for linear systems theory, you don't know what's inside. You just know the behavior of this box. At least in electrical engineering, that's what. So we're trying to get in there and figure out or explain how things actually work inside the box.
I hope people won't take this the wrong way, but with you guys, it could be Pandora's.
Yes, it could be Pandora's box. I've opened a few of those, I can tell you.
For the record,
that's how I got the gray hair.
I suggested fuchsia box, but I was vetoed. So.
Yeah, this is not something like with deciding Pluto's not a planet that people sat around and decided on a color scheme, you know.
But, I mean, most people use modern technology that's based on fundamental science, and it's literally that way. It's a box.
You hit the button, and
you have no idea how it
works. And people don't know what... I recently got a... with money from my mother-in-law and other relatives, pulled it together, and then added some from the Hunt Foundation and bought an espresso machine. Mm-hmm. But it's one of these... our guest was talking about, you know, somebody, you punch a button, and the espresso comes out. This one, you got to grind the beans and the whole deal, so you actually have to do the whole thing.
Okay, and that's what you call it now, the Hunt Foundation?
The Hunt Foundation.
For tax purposes.
Is this the guy that comes out and says, we'll send you one free or for $100, and then you...
No, this is mostly just to explain to my wife why it was that I ended up spending that much money. So the amount I got from relatives, and I had to add some additional stuff to get this thing. But anyway, I would like to introduce our guest, Dr. Frank Loeffler. He joined Georgia Tech April 1st, 1999. He is the Carlton Wilder Associate Professor of Environmental Engineering, endowed chair. Several years ago, he was in Discover Magazine as having one of the top 50 discoveries of that year. He discovered a microbe that breaks down fluorinated hydrocarbons, which will...
So he wasn't the centerfold, as I was led to believe.
That was Playgirl magazine. Okay, that was it. But
gotcha.
And ladies, he is single and available. But anyway,
is that how you got him on? Because he wanted to.
I told him we were going to the cheetah, but
it's the Inside the Black Box new dating service.
Right. But his family owns a vineyard in Germany, and he brought us back a bottle of wine from that, which is very good.
I don't see it.
Not well. Yeah,
it's because Bill drank it at his New Year's Eve party, along with most of the ethanol in the greater Atlanta area.
Yeah, I did. he's also famous for being the founder of Beer Club. Go figure, a German founding something called Beer Club. And it's
ironic.
Faculty members get together and talk about anything but work on Friday afternoons. It's quite a nice social thing.
But that's how he came to be here, so it's a good thing.
Yes, that's right. It's through... we were on a group together a number of years ago. But anyway, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Pete, for having me.
So we will first ask you to define a few things. So first, what's a microbe?
Well, a microbe is something you can't see with your naked eye. It's something very small, but it's very abundant everywhere.
So these are single-celled organisms, bacteria, right?
Typically single-celled organisms. They can occur in clusters, so then they are, you know, several hundred thousand cells together in a cluster. But typically they are single-celled organisms, but they can communicate with each other, and they are basically everywhere. You can go outside, take a tablespoonful of soil. You have more bacteria associated with this soil than you have people on the planet Earth.
Wow.
So they're very abundant everywhere, but we don't see them because they're too small.
Okay. And bioremediation, explain what that is.
Well, these microbes that are everywhere, they must make a living. They do things. And some of these things are very important. They are involved in consumption of organic matter, leaf litter. That has to go back into the carbon cycle, nitrogen cycle. And this is happening by the activity of microbes. And so bioremediation simply takes advantage of these activities of naturally occurring microbes to degrade, detoxify contaminants in the environment. Contaminants typically we put out there because of our activities, anthropogenic activities we call this. And there are some very simple examples that you realize we are all involved in putting contaminants into the environment. And we try to understand how we can use these abundant microbes to mitigate these effects that are harmful to the environment.
So when we say organic, and this is something we've struggled with before, most people think of that as the hormone-free milk that you buy.
Sorry.
You know, basically natural. And a lot of our listeners confuse natural with organic. Organic essentially means the chemistry of life, meaning that upper right-hand corner of the periodic table, most things that involve carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, some of the halogens like chlorine, bromine, things like that. And it's things predominantly, you know, made up of those sorts of things. And that is 90% of the chemistry of life. But we have some funky metals in there as well.
But this is actually a misconception many people still have, that they think pollutants are not organic.
Right.
They actually are organic. That means they occur naturally in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a man-made product, a man-made chemical we introduce into the environment. Most contaminants occur naturally. So they are in the environment already, but they occur in much lower concentrations or in different places. I'll give you a simple example. Would you consider crude oil in its natural location a contaminant?
No.
It's not. When it's in the subsurface, it's sitting there and it's not considered a contaminant. But then we dig it up, pump it to the surface, ship it across the ocean, and the tanker has an accident, and then suddenly it's a major contaminant. So these contaminants already exist on Earth. All we do is we change their locations, and in many cases we change their concentrations tremendously, and then we get these problems.
Mm-hmm. Just to summarize, these microbes will basically take in something you want to get rid of, like an oil slick, for example, and they will
change it,
consume that.
Well, you know, these microbes have some very simple requirements. So what they need is just like what we look forward to. They want food, and so there's a constant competition for food out there. You know, imagine the soil with all these microbes. They need to eat, otherwise they die. So there's a tremendous competition for food. And I can imagine if this organism can suddenly has the ability to use a contaminant as a food source, it has a competitive advantage over all the other ones. And so that's the idea here, why microbes contribute so significantly to bioremediation, because among these many, many microbes, there are a few that can detoxify these chemicals by using them as a food source. Mm-hmm. And that's what we are looking for.
And I think that's a misnomer we've changed over the last few years, which is, you know, decades ago we thought that microbes could only consume a standard set of carbohydrates. Now we're learning that they can consume lots of different things, and that's what we'll talk about right after the break. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM and RadioSandySprings.com.
Thank you. We're back on Inside the Black Box, RadioSandySprings.com with Dr. Frank Loeffler. And one of the things that I wanted to sort of help put it in a context, that the production of alcohol by yeast is a kind of the same process. Dr. Loeffler frowned at me when I said it was bioremediation, but it's essentially taking sugars of various sorts and converting them to alcohol. So that's a microbe consuming something and making something that's terribly useful for us.
And very important to you, Bill,
Apparently,
my visit to your New Year's party.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so this is funny. So this is certainly not bioremediation, but, I mean, the idea is somewhat similar. So the yeast, they need food, and so they recognize the carbohydrates, the sugars, as food. They convert them and gain some energy, some benefit from this conversion, and then they generate an end product that they don't care anymore about. But luckily for us, that's an end product we are very, very keen on getting. It's ethanol, mm-hmm. alcohol.
Right.
And so this is a very important process, not just for converting sugar, but also to generate a product that has tremendous impact on society.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just an example of a microbe doing a job. And, you know, is it, I had heard a few years ago when we were on that panel together, that the major way of doing oil slick cleanups now is bioremediation. Is that true?
That's probably correct. I mean, certainly people do what they can do, you know, with shovels and remove physically. That's certainly helpful. But an enormous amount remains, and you cannot really separate it from the sand and from the rocks and stones. So this remains in the environment, and then microbes take over. And this is actually one of the big success stories for bioremediation, because organisms, microbes, bacteria that can degrade oil components are basically everywhere. You can go to your front yard, and I can promise you I can find microbes there that can degrade crude oil components into CO2. So they use this as a food source. And so that's why actually oil remediation typically works very well. So the microbes are not limiting. Sometimes what's limiting are other substrates these microbes need in order to be really active. And so we have to help them a little bit to get really going.
So substrate is basically just other molecules.
For instance, just like we fertilize, you know, for agricultural production, we add nitrogen fertilizer. Some microbes, or all microbes, also need nitrogen as a substrate. And that's often limiting, especially in the marine environment. So if you add a little bit of fertilizer, you can tremendously speed up this process of this cleanup process. And this is actually a technology that's being used, and we call this biostimulation. So the activity is naturally occurring, but it's not going that well. So we stimulate it by adding certain components. And that could be as simple as a nitrogen fertilizer we use in agricultural production.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you notice when you go to Home Depot, there are two compounds that are always listed on fertilizer. One is phosphorus, the other is nitrogen. Because you remember way back from elementary school and photosynthesis, how plants that you might fertilize get the carbon and the oxygen for what they build, the cellulose, the proteins, from carbon dioxide. But the nitrogen's got to come from somewhere else, and that is what fertilizer is for. Unfortunately, various nitrogen compounds, oxides of nitrogen, aminated-based compounds, nitrate-based compounds, also form explosives, which is why if you go in and buy 8 tons of certain types of fertilizer,
look at you the wrong way.
You're always going to be on the FBI watch list as
well.
Yeah,
I'm just blowing up a stump here. What are you?
So just to clarify something, what you're saying is many of these bacteria occur naturally.
Actually, all the bacteria we are using for bioremediation in the field occur naturally.
Okay.
And there was talk about, you know, 10 years ago, we can now, with these genetic tools we have available,
right,
we can generate bugs, bacteria that can do everything much better.
Mm-hmm.
And this was actually somewhat successful. These bugs could do many things much better in the laboratory. But when you took them from the laboratory back to the natural environment, they were a complete failure. Because they were adapted to the laboratory environment and could not compete anymore in the natural environment. Mm-hmm. So today's understanding is that this is not the way to go,
mm-hmm,
simply because nature has so many solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to recognize what's already available in nature and then make the conditions right for these naturally occurring organisms to make things working.
Okay.
And then, of course, people are always concerned about genetically modified bacteria in the environment. So I don't think really there's a need for that,
mm-hmm,
because I strongly believe that nature had so much time to evolve the right pathways, the right organisms,
right,
that I do not believe that there's a big need for genetically modified organisms,
right,
for bioremediation.
So that's interesting. That's something I was not aware of. We do a lot of genetically modified bacteria and cause them to produce one short peptide strand that might be a drug or a precursor to a drug. But you're right, that's always in well-controlled laboratory experiments. So that's used more, for the example Bill mentioned, to produce a specific pharmaceutical product. But you're right, when you throw it out in nature, they're obviously not robust enough.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So there's no doubt genetic engineering has tremendous opportunities for drug production and many other things in controlled environments, so in the laboratory or in a industrial process. But in the environment, it's a different story because there are such a tremendous diversity of microbes out there. And I told you about the many, many microbes in this one handful or teaspoonful of soil. You also have to imagine this is not just one type of microbe. There are thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, different types of microbes.
Mm-hmm.
So the diversity is just overwhelming. And we understand, I would say, less than 1% of what's out there.
Hmm. Wow.
So there's a lot more work for us to do. And
right.
So that's why we have students, try to get them excited and keep going,
mm-hmm,
discovering the black box.
Well, one of the things, why don't you take us through this discovery? So what's your procedure, what was your procedure for finding this microbe, which has now been licensed to a company.
So, I mean, one of the big drivers in bioremediation are problems we have right in front of our doorsteps. And there's a class of compounds that's basically ubiquitous in aquifers, drinking water aquifers throughout the U.S. And those are chlorinated solvents, in particularly chlorinated ethenes. And you might, that might sound strange to you, but it's actually a compound you know. When you go to a dry cleaner, there's this characteristic smell of a chemical. This is tetrachloroethene. That's used to clean your clothes. And the reason why this is used, it's an excellent solvent that gets rid of the dirt in your clothes. And most importantly, it's not explosive. So it's safe to use. And that's why people use this all over the place. I mean, for dry cleaning operation, in industry, for metal degreasing. And for many decades, people didn't recognize the problem this compound poses to the environment, and it was disposed improperly. And it penetrated the subsurface and is now contaminating drinking water. And so this chemical can be used as a food source by some specialized bacteria, and they can actually then break this down into a non-toxic product. And this is what we would like to achieve. And so our work has, you know, contributed to the discovery of a few bacteria that are involved in this detoxification process.
Okay. We'll pick up here after the break. You're on Inside the Black Box with RadioSandySprings.com.
You're listening to Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM, 51 degrees, and now back to the Black Box.
Thank you. We're back with our guest, Dr. Frank Loeffler from Georgia Tech. Why don't you take us through the discovery? So you were talking about in a teaspoon of soil, you've got, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of different microbes. How did you go about, were you looking for something to clean up fluorinated hydrocarbons, or did you accidentally find this one? It seems like a needle in a haystack.
Well, it's certainly a needle in a haystack. That's a very good expression of describing what we're doing. You have to have an idea of what you're looking for. So you're looking for a specific process that you can monitor and measure analytically. You know, you have an analytical system in a laboratory. You can measure the detoxification of a toxic compound into something that's environmentally benign, non-toxic. And then you just take the soil material. In this case, we collected the soil at a contaminated site that was contaminated with chlorinated solvents. And we incubated that, and we measured, you know, the disappearance of the contaminant and the formation of a non-toxic product in the laboratory. And then we kept enriching this by sequential transfers to fresh medium, and we have some tricks in the laboratory. And it took us, in this case, actually 5 years to get one type of bacterium out of this mixture that had then the ability to catalyze, to transform this toxic compound in something that's non-toxic. And so this was a lot of work and certainly also consumed quite a bit of money, but the outcome was actually very, very good, because we got companies excited who are now using this type of microbe to clean up contaminated environments. And that has now been applied to probably 40, 50 sites across the United States. And in most cases, it was a great success. So that's what I mean. You have to rely on these naturally occurring bacteria. You just have to ask the right questions and then do some good work. And the outcome actually may help us in many different ways. So there's an enormous potential what these microbes can do. And I'm always getting a little bit upset when I see these commercials and they spray Clorox everywhere to kill all the germs. You know, there are certainly a small percentage of microbes that make humans sick, but it's a small percentage. You know, it's less than 0.1% of all the bacteria, all the microbes out there. And all the other ones, these 99.9% of microbes, are very critical that our environment is like it is, that it functions, that you can breathe oxygen, that you can go outside and it looks the way it looks. So you have to have more appreciation for these little things you don't see.
So you really don't like microbist, like racist microbist?
No, certainly not. So the
people at Clorox are microbist.
So Clorox has a good function in certain places, but to kill germs, that's a little bit,
don't kill them all.
Kill them all.
So it's the pathogenic ones that are bad. Yeah. But we see that every day, right?
Yeah. I mean, your gastrointestinal. They're the ones that are hanging out in the dark alleyway.
Right, right. You know. The sort of folks you hang out with.
But, before tattoo microbes.
But we see this all the time, right? I mean, your gastrointestinal tract is filled with microbes. If you go to the store and you buy, let me see if I get it right, Mayfield's 1% milk, it's called AD because it actually has acidophilus in it. And these cultures that are in yogurt and things like that actually can be beneficial to us as humans. So you do see it when you go to the grocery store. So speaking of chlorine, though, you know, you mentioned Clorox, which is a hypochlorite that is very, very bad for bacteria. So what exactly do these bacteria do? They remove the chlorine from chloroethylenes?
Oh, from these chlorinated solvents? Yeah. So this is an interesting process, actually, and this is part of the discovery we made together with others. So these organisms, so these chlorinated solvents are very difficult to degrade because they are chemically extremely stable molecules.
Yes.
And so these organisms use a trick to do that. And so you breathe oxygen, you breathe air to get the oxygen, and then the oxygen is basically fueling your metabolism that you get enough energy, you know, to go jogging, go do stuff. So oxygen is what you breathe. Now these organisms I'm talking about, these bacteria, they don't have oxygen in the subsurface. So they also need to breathe something to make energy. And they developed a system that they can use these chlorinated solvents the same way you use oxygen. Okay, they use them to generate energy, and by doing that, they cleave off these chlorine substituents on these chlorinated solvents, and release them as inorganic chloride. This is just like sodium chloride, what you use for cooking, and this is harmless. And so they transform some toxic compound that has chlorine substituents by breathing them, just like you breathe oxygen, into compounds that are not toxic, and they release chloride in this process.
So they're not consuming them as food.
They use them as a source of energy rather than a source of carbon.
So they're using it as the oxidizer of perhaps carbohydrates instead of oxygen.
Correct, okay. Correct.
So we call that, is this an anaerobic bacteria then?
These are anaerobic bacteria because all these subsurface environments where we have contaminated groundwater are typically depleted of oxygen.
Right.
And these organisms are actually very smart, so they don't use really an organic carbon compound to fuel this process. They use hydrogen gas.
Oh, okay.
So they use a chlorinated solvent as the electron acceptor, the oxygen in this case.
The oxidizer, right.
And they use hydrogen gas, what is abundant actually in subsurface environments.
Right.
So this is available. They use hydrogen gas then to fuel this reaction.
Right. So that was a very good point, actually. We talk about chemicals all the time, and we hear a chemical and we think bad. So chlorine, for example, there was a movement by lobbyists in Congress to get rid of chlorine, period, which would be a bad thing. I mean, you need to understand the difference in the form. So, for example, chlorine as a negative ion is what's in sodium chloride salt, which you need. You must have it.
There's a lot of that in the ocean.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So chloride as an ion...
Well, it's one of the ions that's transported across the membrane in electrically
right.
excitable
you need
cells.
Salt,
right?
I mean, the problem is Americans, we get too much. We worry about hypertension because that wants to suck more water into our bloodstream. But chlorine with some organic molecules hooked up to, in this case, a two-carbon molecule in ethylene, can be very, very bad. Elemental chlorine, Cl2, the gas, is, if you've ever breathed it in,
it's
very,
very bad.
Very bad. But also very useful. We use it because many of the compounds we make, we use acid chloride, so that's very important. It's also important, if you live in this area, they put chlorine in the water to, again, kill these microbes that Frank was talking about before. The nice thing about it is it's a gas. So I don't know about you. I use tap water. But what you find is, in Cobb County at least, a lot of chlorine smell. You can actually sense it. Because it's a gas, if you
put
it in the fridge...
But it's very low concentrations.
Yeah, and then degas it, and it really, in some degrees, outweighs the fact that, you know, you don't want to get cholera and other things from bacteria. So we'll continue talking about this right after the break. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM and RadioSandySprings.com.
Inside the Black Box with Dr. Frank Loeffler. One of the things that I kind of wanted to underscore, so your discovery, and what's the name of, did you like give it a cute name? I'm getting the feeling that you love these microbes and you probably have a lot of them in your home as pets. But what was the name of the strain?
So I think scientists have to apologize. For
I know
the
you
name
named your car, but...
but this organism, actually... this was not us who gave this particular name to this group of organisms. That was already decided for us. And the name is Dihalococcoides. And then we
so sexy. Dihalococcoides.
You know,
yeah.
Dihalo from dehalogenation, from
right.
dechlorination.
Coitus from...
And is, no, no, is it cocci, as in round bacteria?
Well, that was actually a mistake initially okay. that was made. People thought it was a coccus or a sphere-like right. shape of bacterium, but that's actually not true because these organisms are actually shaped like a disc. So a better name would have been Dihalodiscus, but that's too late now, you know, once you made decisions on a name, it's difficult to switch back to another one. But I can tell you that this field in bioremediation now, everybody there knows this name, Dihalococcoides.
And it's called Dihalo because chlorine is a halogen. So
correct.
To
and it's
dehalogenate
correct,
is the reaction.
That, correct. That's right.
So it doesn't have a cute name like your car does?
No, my car's name is Christelle, and that's...
And Christelle got a parking ticket the other day, but let's not. I don't want to get. Yeah, he was ranting on the way over.
None of us are fans
the
of
angstous,
parking at Georgia Tech.
Yeah,
okay, I was asking Bill not to mention.
I'm sorry. He's going to go on a rant.
Does your car have a name, Bill? I'm just
no,
curious.
No.
Mine
neither. No.
We'll have to work on
my
that.
My piano has a name, but that's a different story. But so the other thing is the reason it's so effective is it's not, and I had this misconception before talking to you today, it's not that it takes in the fluorinated hydrocarbons as food that it's going to use as raw materials to construct things within the cell and divide and all that. It's as an energy source, so
correct.
It's going to consume a lot more
correct.
Than if it was just like eating three meals a day or something like that.
Right. So this is actually one of the big advantages of this type of organism, that it uses the contaminant just as a source of energy, and that just means that it needs a lot more of that contaminant in order to make a living. And that also means that it has a much higher turnover rate of the contaminant. Mm-hmm. And this is actually what we're looking for, because we're looking for organisms that detoxify quickly. And so there are many advantages of this particular type of organism.
Now, once they're put into the environment, so let's say, you know, we're in New Jersey, and, you know, the local waste removal service, Guido and Vito, mm-hmm. are trying to, you know, clean up their site. Do they have to monitor? Do they just, you know, put this out there and come back in 6 months, or is there any kind of care and feeding?
I mean, we have different tools for doing site assessment and then bioremediation implementation and monitoring. And most of these tools these days are based on PCR techniques. So we look, we isolate DNA, and then we look for specific
okay,
genes.
Okay, yeah, we'll have PCR. to stop for a second. So if you want to look at genes, I mean, finding DNA is a tough thing to do. So PCR, polymerase chain reaction, which amplifies it
correct.
So you can see what's there.
It's basically environmental forensics, just like, you know, remember OJ and the blood
right.
and so on, and they had to prove it's his. So we use the same techniques, but we are not looking for a murderer or, you know,
right.
some other...
Right.
Unless it was the guy that was spraying the Clorox
right.
bottle
right.
around.
So we are looking for specific genes of organisms that are of interest to bioremediation, mm-hmm. but then use the same techniques. You can imagine when you go to an environment, you don't get a lot of sample. So we use a technique to amplify what we are looking for, that we have enough material to detect it. And that's what PCR does for us.
Right. And those of you, and this has become very popular in getting people interested in analytical chemistry, watch CSI, Crime Scene Investigators. What do they got, 14 versions of that show now? They, you know, whenever you take the half drop of blood, you don't have much DNA either. So this polymerase chain reaction, which got, what is it, Kerry Mullins, the Nobel Prize
right,
about 10 years ago, who has an adjunct appointment at Georgia Tech.
No,
right?
Really?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Oh, that was for years. I think
really?
He's an alumnus. I think he's an alumnus.
He is an alum, but he's
yeah.
also...
Yeah, but he certainly deserved the Nobel Prize for this yeah. discovery
yeah.
because so many people around
right.
the world
so it's used
this
in
this
crime as
yeah.
well as bioremediation.
Right.
So we use these techniques to do site assessment, and then we see if these organisms that can detoxify are present or not. In case they are present, but they don't do it fast enough, you know, then we do what I described before as biostimulation. So we make them a little bit happier that they do it faster. And
play disco music or something like that.
Well, you know, you give them a little bit of additional food, you know, sometimes.
Uh-huh.
There are different tricks we have in engineering companies
mm-hmm.
are implementing.
Right.
And then we monitor if they are becoming more active. And that typically works. But then I agree, there are some sites where you go and you don't find these organisms. They're just not there.
Mm-hmm.
They're not everywhere. And so then the question is, what do you do? And so this is where what I described before, my collaboration with this company in California, we have these cultures available. So we can bring them to the site that doesn't have these organisms, and we inject them into an injection well,
mm-hmm.
and they distribute in the aquifer, and then we hope that they're doing their job, and we can monitor this. And this is called bio-augmentation. So we augment an aquifer with a culture that has a specific capability. And that typically works too. It adds some cost, but the outcome typically is very convincing. So we can introduce this detoxification activity to sites where these organisms are absent.
Right. So, you know, and sometimes we forget that we sort of talk in this scientific engineering world, and the rest of the world doesn't. It gets very confused by it. So augmentation, basically, change or enhancement. Before you talked about
Pamela Anderson had bio-augmentation, just for example.
You talked about incubation before.
So basically augmentation, if you don't have something and then you suddenly have a lot of it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay? So
I got a little wink there that you don't have something.
And before you talked about Anderson
thing. Sorry.
What was it? Incubation, right? Incubation is put it together under controlled conditions and wait.
Right.
My favorite one is inoculation, right? When you take the bacteria on a little inoculating needle, put it on or in.
This is basically augmentation.
Yeah.
You inoculate.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's important to, we use these words that we take for granted,
right.
And you
want to clean up, is it important if the microbes are already there or not there?
It's certainly beneficial if they're already there, because then you can save cost by not doing inoculation or bio-augmentation, mm-hmm. what we call it.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, bio-augmentation by some people is viewed as, you know, you change the ecology of something because you add germs to a system. Mm-hmm. And we looked at this very carefully because we, of course, are concerned. We don't really want to have a negative impact on a subsurface environment. And so we carefully monitored what happens when we do bio-augmentation. And with everything saw to date is that there's absolutely no negative impact of bio-augmentation on the ecology of a natural or a contaminated system in this case. So there's really no concern of doing this.
So we're going to need to take a quick break, and maybe when we come back we can talk about a couple other examples very quickly about dealing with uranium and greenhouse gases by these bacteria. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM and RadioSandySprings.com.
Box, our guest today is Dr. Frank Loeffler, and I realize that he's German, which you could look at as Germ-an. I'm sensing this. He's just like, you know, right on for the germs and...
If you're going to drink before the show starts, you should bring enough for the rest of us.
No, I didn't do it. This is my natural, unbio-remediated sense of humor. But,
that's a leftover from last night.
Yeah. Okay. But the other thing, so uranium, can microbes do something with uranium?
Well, that's another topic we're interested in. And there's a tremendous need from the Department of Energy to clean up their sites. They have large number of sites that are heavily contaminated with radioactive uranium, and that goes back to the production of weapons-grade uranium. The mission at the time was produce as much and as fast as possible, and environmental issues were completely ignored. Mm-hmm. And now all this mess is now in the subsurface. And uranium is a very interesting metal. It's radioactive, sure, but then also it occurs in two different forms. And the form that's typically present is a form we call hexavalent uranium, uranium-6, and this is soluble in water. So it migrates with the groundwater flow, and it goes off-site. It leaves DOE facilities and goes into rivers where it's transported to other places, and, you know, we are exposed to that. And so what microbes can do, they cannot destroy radioactivity. They cannot destroy metals. But what they can do, they can transform metals into a different form. And they can reduce hexavalent uranium to uranium-4. And this uranium-4 has different properties. It precipitates as a mineral called uraninite. And then it's not soluble anymore in water, and it doesn't migrate. And this is a different form of bioremediation. You don't destroy the contaminant, but you change its properties. Mm-hmm. And that can also be used to contain the contaminants on-site, and it doesn't reach receptors like us using drinking water.
So let's say if you were going to be hunting for something that would be useful for this, would you look near an existing uranium site because the microbes would have sort of moved in there?
This is a typical, you have the idea, you go to a contaminated site and then you look for the activity or looking for you want to find. But in this case, actually, these uranium-reducing bacteria that produce this uraninite, they all iron-reducing bacteria. Many bacteria in subsurface environments, they reduce iron, and they can also reduce uranium. So these organisms are actually very distributed. They are quite common in the subsurface and in soil.
Right, and so, for example, this different type of uranium, metals tend to be positive. They can lose their very sort of volatile electrons, and whether it's a plus 6 or a plus 4 is very, very important, as Frank pointed out. So when he says reduce, it means that these bacteria are adding electrons to it, right? Gain in electrons is reduction. But this has got to be important for a lot of things. What about the whole Aaron Brockovich movie and the hexavalent chromium?
Oh, this is pretty much the same story. Yes. So organisms that reduce hexavalent chromium to trivalent chromium, that reduces toxicity and it changes mobility.
Right.
And that's exactly the same what these uranium-reducing bacteria do. They don't change toxicity in this case, but they change mobility.
Right.
And that's what DOE is very interested in, stimulating this type of activity so that the uranium doesn't spread any further.
Right. So the ability to change its oxidation state can take it from very, very dangerous to something that's less dangerous or can be processed or
correct,
dealt with.
Correct.
So greenhouse gases, how can they help with greenhouse gases, microbes?
Oh, yeah, most of
and
the...
And can they balance my check?
I mean, everybody talks about CO2, certainly, but CO2 is coming from the tailpipes, crude oil, and so on. We all know about this. But microbes are also significant contributors to greenhouse gas production, but also consumption. And that's very important to know. So all the methane in landfills and so on is typically produced by microbes. Microbes produce methane.
Mm-hmm.
And this methane goes into the atmosphere where it causes global warming. But there are other types of microbes, not the ones that produce methane, other ones that can consume methane. Mm-hmm. And those, of course, are very important because they mitigate the effects of greenhouse or methane emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to understand much more about those organisms, how we can stimulate their activity to actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Another example is in agricultural production, we fertilize.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this fertilizer, nitrate and ammonium, is through microbial activity converted to a gas that's called nitrous oxide. This is actually the laughing gas when you go to the dentist.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually a fun gas to work with. So they produce this N2O. It's a very strong greenhouse gas, about 300 times stronger greenhouse gas than CO2. So this is produced by microbes, but we also know and we discovered numerous of these microbes, they can consume N2O, nitrous oxide. So they can reduce greenhouse gas emissions from agricultural fields. We try to understand these processes, open the black box, and then hope to stimulate those processes that are beneficial to the environment.
Hmm. And firstly, we've come to the end of our time. Is it safe to say that what we've learned today is that Mother Nature already does bioremediation, we just need to learn how to harness it?
That's correct. I think if we would understand nature a little bit better, we would be much better off.
And, of course, the other thing we've learned, as Frank pointed out, that given the recent death of Ralph the whale shark, you may want to avoid the DeKalb Farmers Market.
Yeah, if you got shark meat, $4.95 a pound,
Yeah, watch out.
All right.
Next week, we've got Professor Mark Guzdow from the College of Computing at Georgia Tech. Who will be talking about computer science, not just for nerds anymore, and some educational techniques that they're doing. And I'll be at the Showcase Comedy Lounge again tonight, and later in the month, February 10th, Bill will be joining me for Pocket Protectors and Other Fashion Statements, a comedy show sponsored by the MIT Alumni Club of Atlanta.
Yeah.
Next up is a garden party, and we'll see you next week on Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs.
All right.